Section 1 of Christmas Comes But Once a Year. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ruth Golding. Christmas Comes But Once a Year by John Layton. Showing what Mr. Brown did, thought, and intended to do during that festive season, now first edited from the original Mess, with notes and illustrations by Luke Limner, Esquire. Prime Movers. John Brown, Esquire, citizen of London and suburban snob. John Brown, Jr., Esquire, fast gent. Son and heir to the above. Brick, I believe you, my boys, rather. Master Thomas Brown, apple of his mother's eye, her Tommy Wommy, her dear boy, her jewel of a pet. Captain Bonaventure de Camp, officer, late of the Honourable East India Company's service, but now at the service of anyone. Latimer de Camp, master of hearts, elder son of the above, of Nobody Knows College, Oxford. Wellesley de Camp, cadet of Sandboys Military College. Suavo Spoof, composer, organist at St. Stiff's the Martyr, Mr. Brown's ex-friend. John Brown, footman to John Brown, Esquire, late private in the 44th foot. Tobias Strap, grocer in greens, landlord to Mr. Spoof, and supernumerary help to anybody. Ichabod Strap, son of his sire, commonly called Alfonso, but sometimes Buttons. Mrs. Benigma Brown, rib of John Brown, Esquire, ruler of his roast and boiled. Miss Jemima Brown and Miss Angelina Brown, eligible young ladies, very so, to anyone inclined to a matter of money-all alliance. Lady Lucretia de Camp, spouse of the captain, lady in her own right and wrong. Deborah Strap, consort of T.S. above, pew-packer at St. Stiff's the Martyr. Guests, cooks, maids, lantern-bearers, extra flunkies, police, etc., 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 etc. Scene: Victoria and Albert Villas, Mislington, near London. Time: Christmas. Section 1. Very cold, very bleak. The thermometer and snow are falling fast. Eggs and suet are rising faster. Everything at this season is prized, and everybody apprises everybody else of the good they wish them. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Even the shivering caroller, for it is a poor heart that never rejoices, is yelling forth the tidings of comfort and joy. The snow that descends, making park and common alike, topping palace and pigsty, now crowns the semi-detached villas Victoria and Albert. They were erected from the designs of John Brown, Esquire, and his architect or builder, and are considered a fine specimen of compo cockney Gothic, in which the constructor has made the most of his materials, for, to save digging, he sank the foundation in an evacuated pond, and, as an antidote to damp, used wood with the dry rot, the little remaining moisture being pumped out daily by the domestics. The floors are delightfully springy, having cracks to precipitate the dirt, and are sloped towards the doorways, so that the furniture is perpetually trying to walk out of the rooms. But those apertures are ingeniously planned to prevent the evil, the doors obstinately refusing to open at all without force. That the whole may not appear too light, few windows are introduced. By casual observers, the Victoria and Albert would be taken for one, so united are they, and had we not seen the parting division, we should have doubted also. Of the entrance lodges, we have noticed one of the chimneys smoking periodically, and from the mollient white vapour issuing over the window at such times, presume Victoria is washing, whilst Albert is locked up and doing nothing. Their lord and master is John Brown, Esquire, director of the Deptford Direct, the Stag Assurance, and churchwarden of this parish, St. Stiff the Martyr. A portly, upright man, for had he not been so erect to balance a fair round belly, he would have toppled on his nose. Everybody said that he was clever, too, and, moreover, always thought so. For luck had made our friend a rising man amongst the suburban aristocracy of Mislington. Of Mrs. Brown, she is his match, and portly, too, though older and more crusty. A crummy dame to whom her lord must bow, for, upon his hinting at duty, and an obedient wife's commanding her husband, she ordered him off, reading the adage as a woman ought. Of the Misses Brown, Jemima and Angelina, they are decidedly getting old for young ladies, having been out for some time, and, like the back numbers of an old periodical, are not the more interesting or marketable for it. Of the sons, the elder, John Brown Jr., is spoiling himself by patronizing all that is fast, whilst the younger is being educated for a faster age, being spoilt first by his mother. Having characterized the Brown family, we will now introduce you to the first scene of this domestic drama. Victoria Villa, a dormitory, midnight. In the background may be seen and heard a lady in a rich, mellow snore, whilst distant music, the Christmas waits, is softly o'er the senses stealing, and loud in the promise of a good time coming, provided you will wait a little longer. Mr. Brown is seated at the dressing-table making up his diary, or rather trying to cram the events of 24 hours into the leaf of a pocket-book 5.5 inches by 3¼, his usual custom before rest.
December 21st, Friday. Advertised in this day's Times to let Albert furnished from the 25th, with use of servants if required, double house and household at half price, grand effect united with economy. Tommy came home from Dr. Tortum's with holiday letter, bill, and wonderful crop of hair, considering it costs me 5 shillings per quarter to cut. Brimstone and treacle under head, medicine charged 10 and 6, firing and broken windows £2, etc. What most unlucky things turn up on a Friday. I much wish I had not advertised Albert today. No one will come. With these observations and a consolatory grumble about Christmas coming but once a year, Mr. Brown seeks repose beside his consort, whilst the waits make the lowing wind, the frigid vegetation, and the rattling shutters dance again to the bridal polka. Sweet sleep, and morning dawns. The Browns depart, as is their daily custom, by the omnibus, the elder to chat inside, the younger to smoke out, and both to business in the city. Whilst at home, Master Tommy displays the advancement made in his studies, as the holiday letter states, by practising writing in the Book of Beauty,
his knowledge of natural history by attempting to rear goldfish, like eels, in sand, searching for the tick in an 8-day clock, setting bits of raw beef in the back garden that the portion, like potatoes, might grow to young bullocks, filling the bellows snout with gunpowder that they may blow the fire up, putting the cat in walnut shells upon the icy pond and himself in the middle of it, playing racket in the drawing-room and constructing a snowman against the back door to fall in upon Sarah, almost frightening her to death, and many other experimental philosophical tricks, too numerous to mention. During this day, the semi-detached is besieged by a lady and gentleman in search of a home. The gentleman, dressed in a very tight frock-coat, dusty and worn, a highly glazed cap, the strap of which dangled above a tuft of hair that graced his chin, its peak resting upon the tip of his nose, affording him little more than a view of his boots, with a portion of the hose protruding therefrom, his tightly strapped trousers carrying a broad stripe, of which he appeared proud, being engaged in the manufacture of many more in other parts by knocking the dust out of them with a slight cane. Of his gloves, they seemed determined to end their days in their normal state, and to produce neither mitts nor fingerstalls. The couple, looking very limp and tumbled, a thing duly apologized for, and not to be wondered at, having just arrived from abroad. Mrs. Brown, being much taken with the gentleman, for he curried favour by stroking only the way of the grain. So, with Lady Lucretia, Captain de Camp of the Honourable East India Company's service, from Madras, awaiting his luggage, is at home in the Albert, having given himself a character that satisfied Mrs. Brown, for he omitted the objectionable parts, fearing they might distress that good lady, like the woman with a large family, who, finding it impossible to get lodgings, sent her children among the graves, that, when asked, she might say with a sigh, "Alas, they are all in the churchyard." That evening Mrs. Brown's rich, mellow snore commenced later than usual, for she had been loud and long in the praise of their new neighbours. Mr. Brown, making entry against December the 22nd, Saturday, that Albert was let, whilst the waits were playing the phantom dancers, and Captain de Camp busy there, screwing his empty trunk to the floor, that it might appear heavy and full of valuables, and whilst between the villas in the rear there might be seen a glimmering candle, and by that light be found, one not unknown to Brown, a poor little musician in a little second-floor room containing a little organ much too large for it, and a litter of dirty soft papers, who is not a little perplexed at a note from Mrs. Brown dispensing with his services. He, the poor little music-master, more amiable than handsome, less symmetrical than serviceable, who had in less favoured times contracted friendship, and to teach the Mrs. Brown music at 30 shillings per quarter, who had gotten so familiar as to love, had dared to offer that person nature had deformed with that mind nature had adorned to Miss Jemima Brown. There was a time when his anecdotes had been prized, and his long, delicate white fingers kept playing to perpetual dancers, and that fine voice nature had bestowed in lieu of symmetry sang the merriest and most sentimental songs for love. The retrospect is too much for poor Spoof, so he seeks refuge in his organ, much to the annoyance of a little tailor in the attic who has no soul in him, save the soul he had for supper. Sunday, The perpetual bell of St. Stiff the Martyr is calling to service, as it is wont to do at all times and hours, for mysterious purposes but little known. It seems as if the bell disliked its little wooden cottage on the unfinished spire, or was inspired, or in a towering passion, to live in a tower, or saw no fun in waiting for funds, and so continually pealed an appeal to the public. However, it was a puny little curious bell with a tongue of its own, now clacking for a charity sermon. And curiously, Mr. Brown thinks a charity sermon always edifies him with the headache, and is doubtful about going, as they make him a reluctant giver for mere vain show. But he curiously wonders where the De Camps go, and curiously Victoria and Albert meet at the gate, and curiously the family pew at St. Stiff's seems capable of accommodating them. Mr. Spoof, the little organist, being perched up aloft, sees through the curtain the Christmas holly and the captain, taking care to mark that individual with mental chalk. The musician's eyes are in the brown pew, but the eyes that used to meet them are turned another way. All favour is centred upon their spurious exotic, who grows thicker, twines tighter, and takes deeper root the more he is encouraged. Of the species or genus, we cannot do better than quote Mr. B.'s own words, written against December the 23rd, Sunday, whilst the Waits, as usual, were serenading the semi-detached in a full conviction of its being Monday, and the possibility of living and loving together, and being happy yet. To church with my new tenant, who is delightful company. Lady Lucrece says he is a refined duck, a gentlemanly angel, and a manly poppet, to which I made answer that I thought so too, and that she was a seraphine concert. Sermon by the Reverend Loyola A. Beckett, in aid of funds for supplying the poor during this inclement but festive season with food for the mind. Captain De Camp did borrow a sovereign of me to put in the plate, and I was told by my fellow churchwarden, Mr. Flintflayer, that he did put in a bad shilling, wrapped in paper, and did take out 15 shillings in change. This, I said, was untrue, as of course it was, having lent him a sovereign myself for the express purpose. We are to have Captain de C.'s 2 noble sons here during the holidays. One, I believe, comes from Oxford, and the other from Sandboys Military College. Now is the time. Jemmy and Angel must be on the alert. For there is a tide in the affairs of women, which, taken at the flood, leads on to matrimony. Omitted all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in spinsterhood. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. Monday, the 24th of December's sun rises in a fog. Everybody has lost the day of the week, and come upon what appears an infinity of Saturdays rolled into one, beginning the week with a grand end, for it is the advent of Christmas. The masters De Camp arrive as was expected, Cadet Wellesley exhibiting his military accomplishments by surveying the back field, all the holes and corners, riddling the sty and pigs with Mr. Brown's blunderbuss, bivouacking in the pantry at Victoria's expense, and, when remonstrated with, for mere sport, knocking the plaster Albert off the garden wall into the lane. Mr. Latimer de Camp introduces himself more civilly, as Miss Jemima is playing and singing, of course for practice, by accompanying How Happy Could I Be With Either on the wooden partition with his thumb, after the fashion of a tambourine. This is the annual busy day. Packets and parcels are being delivered unceasingly by uncommonly civil butcher boys, graceful grocers, and urbanic greengrocers, who are near enough to Boxing Day to know that silver on the tongue is necessary to charm silver from the pocket. The captain has sent to learn if any consignments are for him, to ask the loan of a pack of cards, and Victoria's company to spend the evening at the Albert, which invitation is graciously accepted. It is Eve, Christmas Eve. Mrs. Brown's candied mixture, the pudding, is simmering in the copper. The turkey, chine, and hundred etceteras are on their way from Plumpsworth, while Captain de Camp's baggage is at the very wildest verge of that gentleman's imagination, and its appearance would have surprised him more than anyone else, so speculative was it. Mr. Brown is in the city, homeward bound by the omnibus, intending to realize a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. It is so foggy that he finds he is going at an invisible pace, obliging him to abandon the invisible vehicle in an invisible street, paying an invisible fare. He ties a handkerchief round his foot to prevent slipping, and has something short to keep out the cold, and a little brandy punch to keep out the fog, and a little egg flip to keep him warm, and a link that he may see the way, for his vision is not very distinct. His head is delightfully buoyant, his optics inclined to multiply, and his legs very refractory, having a great desire to dance or go sideways, but obstinately refusing in their eccentricity to proceed in a straight line. For Mr. Brown is more merry than particular, taking Newgate Market in his way home to Mislington from the Change. Having a great veneration for old customs, he buys a boar's head there, and boy to carry it. Next, being taken with a crockery shop sign, the little basin, which, by the by, was a very large one, he purchases that also, thinking it will do for a wassail bowl. Likewise some holly, and an old butcher's block to serve as the yule log, not forgetting the last new Christmas book of sympathy and sentiment, The Black Beetle on the Hob, a fairy tale of a register stove, by the author of The Old Hearth Broom and the Kettle Holder. With these articles, Mr. Brown and his retinue reach home in safety, a miracle considering the toast and ale they have consumed. The holly being jolly, the basin groggy, the log stupid, and the boar pig-headed. They find Victoria deaf, for Mr. Brown has made her little Gothic door to shiver and the bolts to chatter with the blows, yet none respond, for the servants are very jovial over boiled ale in the crypt, little thinking or caring about their master, who, after having rung all the bells singly, walked backwards, surveyed the windows, tumbled over the block, and endangered the wassail bowl, tries ringing all the bells at once without avail, so enters by the back window and performs a dexterous somerset down the stairs, in company with some evergreens and a flower stand, ending in a series of double knocks performed upon the inside of the door with the back of his head, and a cuffing from Mr. Brown, Jr., who happens to be coming in with the key, taking his respected governor for a burglar. The Browns are next door. Victoria is fraternizing with Albert, and both are exceedingly happy, although the latter has won greatly at the game of speculation, having played his cards well. So Mr. Brown, after being packed in brown paper, steeped in vinegar and well soda-watered, joins the social party, finding Captain de Camp busy concocting an extraordinary oriental mixture, the name of which we quite forget, out of old bottles from Victoria's cellar, and telling a tremendous eastern story of a tiger captured in a jungle after a chase of 10 hours. He should have said minutes in a penny magazine. Mr. Brown and the captain soon became familiar. In 20 minutes you would have thought them friends of 20 years. So, before the last speculator had invested his last weekly sixpence in a goose club and drawn the last adamantine old gander, or the last Christmas pudding sweep swept away the chimerical puddings that ought to have been very rich, and everybody thought everybody else had won, before the last trader who had sold out dared to mount a notice intimating that he had joined an association to suppress Christmas boxes, the Browns and de Camps had attained that state denominated thick, an appellation that might, with propriety, have been applied to Mr. Brown's brains. For he had obliged Captain de Camp by discounting a bill due 12 days after date, Christmas, and had invited him to dine on the morrow, to partake of the poultry that always came up at Christmas from Plumpsworth, and was taken out in a visit made by the worthy donor, great-uncle Clayclod, during the May meetings, when he does a dozen shilling exhibitions in a day and knocks up a fly-horse. So, rather late to bed, Mr. Brown making up his diary as usual on the dressing-table, a rule he always observed, though in some cases it would have been better left until the morning, for against December 24th, Tuesday, we find his feelings richly expressed in cramped calligraphy, upside down, bearing evident marks of excitement, having been penned in a dream with hair dye mistaken for ink, pounced with carmine, and blotted with the small tooth-comb in lieu of paper. It is, moreover, curious for its allegorical allusions, likening Captain de Camp to a brick, a downy card, a sharp file, and several other inanimate poetical images. Of our mild friend Spoof, he is sleeping soundly upon a light supper obtained from St. Stiff's dairy. Some very thin milk, divested of all unctuous quality, that having gone to an epicure captain at the Albert Villa. Poor Spoof's talent has not put many talents in his purse. These real racing times run over genius. They would tunnel Helicon, turn Hippocrene to flush a city's drains, make Pegasus serve letters by carrying a postboy, and in the end sell the noble beast for feline food. Everything now must be tangible. The little organist who had spent so many a merry Christmas with the Browns, he has no pleasure to anticipate on the morrow, except the performance of his new hymn, The Star of Bethlehem, a composition of which the little tailor in the attic thought small things, for it did not compose him to sleep. End of section 1.